And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, you're a big animal lover, so you'll enjoy speaking about today's topic.
Yes, I will indeed.
Well, we'll discuss human's best friend, the dog. It's hard to imagine that a petite Yorkshire Terrier is a descendant of the gray wolf, but it is. So is the German Shepherd, the Mastiff, and Borzoi. Joining us now is New York Magazine executive editor John Homans. His adoption of a mixed lab female puppy spurred his writing of What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. And John Homans joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, John.
Thanks for having me.
So, how's Stella doing today, and what is she doing as we speak?
Her fame hasn't gone to her head, which is good. but she is probably sleeping on the floor of my apartment, unless my wife has taken her out. And she's probably a little bit mad, but she doesn't know that next week we're going hiking in the snow in the Adirondacks, and she's going to be the happiest dog in all of New York.
So she's a keep off the couch and bed dog.
She actually, it's one of her good qualities, and she does have some. She actually has never really aspired to get on the furniture. She really prefers to be on the floor, and you actually can't get her to jump up on the table for some reason. She seems to have some internal prohibition that I have not figured out. Even though she's physically capable of jumping over the table, she won't get up there.
Why did you say she's a little bit mad right now?
Oh, because she wants me to. She really would rather be outside, and I think all the time that the life she should have, and the life a wolf would have, and the life is a life that is kind of outdoors and off the leash and in the woods and walking around, and to the degree that she's confined in our loft, she is not living life to its fullest. But she has a very nice life. I mean, she gets 5 or 6 walks a day, which is more than a lot of dogs that we know, and goes. Go to the dog run. I'm probably exaggerating and giving myself, but 4 to 5, I would say.
You say that Stella's arrival on my rug was the arrival of great forces of history. How was that?
Well, you know, when we acquired her, of course, I thought she was just a dog. But then when I began to, she was from Tennessee, and that interested me, and I began to look up and discover why that was, and it's because, you know, the rescue dog movement has been so successful in places like Long Island and probably Florida in the Miami area, I imagine, that they're not really unleashed dogs, and dogs don't breed, and there are not so many dogs that aren't pit bulls to rescue. I mean, that's what happened on Long Island, and the shelter where I got her now gets most of its dogs, almost all of its dogs, from the South. And the Midwest, because the South and Midwest, there's an older dog culture that they're more unleashed dogs, and dogs aren't spayed and neutered as much, and as a consequence, they're more rescue dogs. So that's one of the things. And the other thing is that Stella is, to the degree that she's a Labrador, and she looks precisely like a Labrador, she's originally from, the founder dogs were from Newfoundland, and brought over in the 18th century to England, and then and 18th and 19th, and then refined at some of the great ducal estates of England, and then brought back in a Labradors were brought back to America in a burst of Anglophilia in the 1930s, and so they're really it's a rich, complicated, surprisingly complicated story about something so simple as the dog. I mean, there's more. That's only the briefest of sketches of it. But it turned out that what the book is about is to see how kind of rich and tangled and complicated and fascinating is the story of this fairly simple thing that seems fairly simple that's sleeping on my rug.
The other day on the radio, I heard. A comic routine. I think the comic's name is John Caparulo, And he was getting a mutt dog from the pound, and his friend said, oh, well, that's not a very intelligent dog. And John Caparulo said, well, I don't expect him to run errands for me or do my taxes. I just want him to wag his tail and be happy when I get home and let me pet him.
Absolutely. Well, also, a mutt is not as a mutt is not any less intelligent than a purebred right. dog, too. But you know, people can have dogs for all sorts of different reasons. Actually, I wrote about that dogs are not in an IQ sense, in a strictly intelligent sense, anywhere near as smart as humans, of course. But even of chimpanzees, but they do have some remarkably human abilities, and the ability is to the genius of a dog, and it's also genius of people, is that a dog is kind of ready to be helped. It can, and in a way that a chimpanzee isn't. For instance, a lot of scientists, there's a lot of controversy about this, but scientists noticed about 15 years ago that a dog can understand a human point in a way that a wolf, or interestingly, a chimpanzee can't. And the reason is that even though a chimpanzee is much smarter than a dog in a kind of purely, IQ sense. And the reason is that a chimpanzee will think that you're being, that it wouldn't understand why you want to point to something that was food. That you wouldn't understand why you wanted to help it. Whereas that, for a human baby, that's the first linguistic gesture that they understand and use is, pointing, it's called what's known as shared intentionality. Like you point at something, and both of you and the baby are both looking at something, and then you can have a discussion about that or have an interaction about that. And a chimp can't do that. But interestingly, a dog, can do that, quite a young dog. And that is, and it's the base of these, some of these scientists think that the kind of shared intentionality is the basis of the first step on the not that the dog isn't going to get there, but they think that for humans it was the first step on evolving language. So that was one of the things. It's a commonality that we have with dogs because we're both such social creatures.
And why is this understanding the pointing motion so disputed among the scientific community?
Well, I'll tell you that because understand what the reason is that understanding the difference between a dog and a wolf is very complicated. Even though they're clearly different, and wolves are much harder to have a shorter development window, they're much more skittish, and they're harder to. And so, deciding how to train a wolf to participate in these tests, and then how to conduct the tests, is a subject of fairly enormous dispute. I mean, there are labs in various places that are hand raising these wolves, and the handlers sleep with the wolves, and they're basically trying to acclimate the wolves to human contact in order to understand what they're able to have a sort of an apples to apples test of how they're different. But then other scientists say, no, you're this is like a circus trick, and you're teaching these wolves more than they deserve to know to make these tests equal. And so they're still that. I don't know if they're ever going to work this question out.
Hmm. I was struck by the information in the book, John, about how trying to compare how wolves are experimented with psychologically in captivity is like trying to understand human interactions from a prison.
Yeah, no, it's true that it's just a different universe. I mean, the wolf's diet, which you could write books and books about this, but wolves were so difficult to study that they didn't really understand until recently that this whole alpha wolf business was actually, the alpha wolf was actually just the daddy wolf, and these were family groups, that a wolf pack is really a family group. And the reason that they thought they were so violent was that they had studied wolves previous to that. They studied captive wolves, and that did form these kind of very violent pack-like things that were like prisons. It was quite a bit like prison life, and it wasn't until a scientist named David Meach, who spent a long time up in Ellesmere Island in I think it's British Columbia, you know, spent a long time observing them and discovered that, in fact, a wolf pack is a family group, and the younger wolves, the betas, and are actually adolescents, and that's the reason why they're not permitted to breed with. And then they eventually go off and found their own. If they're lucky, go off and found their own packs. So.
So do you think dogs should be trained and that there should be the human alpha male, that they're looking for that?
You know, I don't. I'm not an expert on dog training, and as you'd see if you'd meet Stella, although she can do certain, she can give you her paw and sit and lie down, and unless she's too excited. But I tend not to believe, you know, I think Cesar Millan is a brilliant dog trainer. And I think that he's obviously able to get these animals to do things that he wants them to do. And he's a gifted, actually Malcolm Gladwell, the New Yorker, wrote quite a good piece about this a while ago. But
right.
he's a great animal communicator. And it's a kind of charisma that some people have. I mean, but I think that the theoretical basis, be the alpha, I don't think is true.
I had a female.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I just am not. I tend to believe that the alpha that there's no such thing as an alpha, and that there are certainly qualities that one could have in one's presentation, confidence, and that would convince a dog to do what you wanted. And also, I think that. I'm not an expert, but I tend to believe that some negative reinforcements are useful at times with a dog. But I think that the whole superstructure of the alpha and be the alpha and a lot of the things that he tries on his show are not necessarily things that everyone should try. And I think that the idea behind them is not precise, not really accurate in terms of what a dog is.
We're speaking with John Homans. He's the executive editor of New York Magazine. He's written What's a Dog For? On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and John Homans. He's the author of What's a Dog For? And, John, I was trying to interject before that we were talking about training dogs. Should they be trained? And I had a beautiful little female Doberman who loved to go out and go on the front lawn and pick up the paper every morning. It made her day. One time she got loose, and I had 5 or 6 newspapers on the porch, so she really got into it.
You know, speaking of dogs liking to do things for humans, I was interested to know, you know, it does appear that dogs look for our approval versus cats that seem to
not care.
care sure. less about our approval. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that dogs are that there is a commonality between, it's related to this pointing business, but there is a commonality between dogs and humans because we're both social creatures. I mean, unlike the cat. I actually find we have cats too, of course, and I find the cat's, eagerness for human contact and sensualism especially mysterious, given that they're so solitary in the wild. Whereas the dog, wolves are very incredibly social. They're incredibly. They share food. They you know, greet each other. They need to. They wither without social contact. And I think a lot of those things have been translated into. I mean, the uniqueness of the dog is that it is found. Humans are readily allowed into its social world. I mean, if you watch Cell on the Street, you'd think that those are really her, that rather than dogs, those are her people. I mean, she really acts differently to people and dogs. She's a little more afraid of dogs than people, and she's very friendly. But there are special, humans are a special category of of creatures like her, I often think, and I think that that's a legacy of their social lives as wolves.
We're speaking with John Homans. He's written What's a Dog For? If you'd like to know something about the surprising history, science, philosophy, and politics of Man's Best Friend, or if you want to talk about your dog with John Homans, on today's Topical Currents, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-WLRN. Or you can email radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org.
What about the controversy? I wasn't aware that there was such scientific controversy about why dogs and humans are so close and the cognitive adaption powers and or whether it's just another animal. Give us a thumbnail of the various theories.
Well, you know, a thumbnail. I'll give you a thumbnail history. I mean, Darwin was a man of his time, and in Victorian England. Early Victorian England, there was the cult of the dog. I mean, they just thought that dogs were the smartest, most loyal, most faithful, most greatest creatures, and they had all these human qualities, and it was partly, but they were, I mean, dogs were great creatures, and then the training and the civilization made them even better, and Darwin was very much a man of his time in that, and he was inspired by the dog to see, I'm paraphrasing or really inventing, but a dog was really a model for him for believing that, you know, humans were like other creatures and could be related to other creatures. And he wrote a great deal about dogs in his notebooks, and then in The Descent of Man wrote a lot about how the commonalities between dogs and humans and how and use that as an example to persuade a skeptical audience that yes, we might actually be related to the animals, because no one wanted to be related to a monkey, of course, even though it was clear that monkeys were, but they're closest to us. But dogs were people loved their dogs and were happy to be related to dogs. So Darwin used them in that way. But after Darwin, it took a few decades, but people began to think less and less, and partly this was because of the intelligence of dogs, and in fact all animals, and put humans on pedestals and thought that humans were the only ones that had real thoughts. And it wasn't until Jane Goodall who had a dog, beloved dog, before she went to Africa, and the dog, I mean, she anthropomorphized the dog and realized that the dog had all these human-like qualities and used some of those insights about her dog to apply to, the chimpanzees at Gombe, that that people began to believe that, other animals could be intelligent. I mean, the debate is still going on between behaviorists who think that it's all, this pointing stuff is all about learning rather than some kind of special kind of social cognitive instinct. And people like this Brian Hare and some of these people who think that there's more. That there is kind of a richer kind of intelligence, not like a fully human intelligence, but there are qualities that we share. That there are many that they don't have as many tools in the toolbox, but some of the tools are similar to the ones that we have. And a behaviorist has a much sterner view of the limits of an animal intelligence. One dog trainer, behaviorist dog trainer, says, "Well, these are lemon brains."
So that would include Pavlov.
Pavlov is a kind of a proto behaviorist. He's the beginning of that school that says things are. I mean, at the time it was radical to think that you could have these mental secretions. The brain worked in that way, but that it seemed to close off the, mentalism. The idea that there's thinking going on began to disappear from the from the world with Pavlov, and didn't really come back until Jane Goodall and really Noam Chomsky, and that was in the late 1950s when the view of the animal brain began to expand again. But behaviorism in dog training, because clicker training, which is essentially a behaviorist method, is still as powerful a thing in the dog training world as it's ever been. So behaviorism never, and it's effective. It's hugely effective. It may not be as effective as kind of behaviorism with, you may need to add other kinds of refinements to it to make it the best dog training method. But there's lots and lots of behaviorist dog trainers, and it's very effective, and it's useful as far as it goes. I don't tend to think that it's a complete picture. Behaviorism provides a complete picture of what might be going on in the minds of a dog.
Do domestic dogs feel anger? Can they be vindictive? Can they pout?
Oh,
well, he said Stella was mad. Yeah.
What's that?
You said Stella was mad when we opened up the interview.
Yeah. I think that although I didn't dig deeply into the science, but I think that certainly it's true that dogs are mad and afraid and are mad and afraid of specific people. I know that Stella, certain kinds of dogs are, she's afraid of big dogs, but she's afraid of certain dogs that look a certain way or act a certain way or specific animal she has fear of, and other ones she's in love with, and other ones she wants to chase around the dog run. So I don't have any doubt that there are those kinds of that a dog has those kinds of capabilities. Interestingly, crows have these amazing capabilities of recognition as well. I think it's fairly common in the animal world. It's hard to study these things in the wild, but many animals recognize different individuals.
How long have you had Stella now?
I've had her. She's five and a half.
So when and why did you begin treating her as a person? How long did it take for you to begin treating her as a person?
I think you kind of notice that that's what she is, and I was curious because part of the reason I was curious was my father, has become increasingly passionate about his dogs as he's gotten older, and they were surrogate kids to him or something, and I began to say, well, this is, and then I look around and everyone is obsessed with their dogs, and in my social world, a lot of you have the kids that are getting a little bit older, they're teenagers, and then people become without these young kids to care for anymore, people seem to become more and more obsessed with their dogs, and so I was recognizing that there is this, that there are. And I recognize it, of course, in myself too, because I have a 15-year-old son that they can take the place of this kind of caregiving, and it's something to talk about. And so, yeah, it was both in my own world and other people's worlds. And then I also thought, well, maybe I shouldn't treat Stella as a person. Not that I could leave her outside New York City, but maybe I should. Kind of draw lines and make sure that I don't treat her. And so I became curious about what that meant, and I found that, it seemed to be, an interesting, very prevalent New York City phenomenon. You have these animal hospitals that have where you can go and you can have a dog, you can have your dog treated for cancer and end up spending $30,000,
right.
And you say, well, this is, and the hospital is right there in Hospital Row, and you say, well, this is not the way I was brought up with dogs. I mean, you might spend $200 at the veterinarian, but that's, you weren't gonna have a dog get a hip replacement, and people do this. It's easy to do it. I had a friend. Another inspiration for the book was that I had a friend who had a sick dog. It was a sad story, but. One of those brilliant dogs, very human-like dog, but had some blood in its stool, and they took the dog in on a Friday afternoon, and they came out on Monday morning with with a dead dog and a bill for $15,000. And then you say, well, this world is, there's something that's a little bit confused about the way this world and the way this happens.
They could have bought Lassie. You know,
yeah, right. You could have, or you would have had health insurance, or it was both a person and not a person, and it was, there was all sorts of issues. So I became interested in what those issues, I began to explore what those issues were, and then sort of explored this Darwin and you know, what the dog's mental capabilities are, and how dogs fit into human culture in a lot of different ways.
We're speaking with New York Magazine executive editor John Homans about his book, What's a Dog For? It's time for another short break. We'll be back with more.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents Tuesday edition. We're Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with John Homans. He's the executive editor of New York Magazine, and his book is What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. John, I wanted to mention that you got your dog from the North Shore Animal League, and we have an emailer here, Jenna. She said she'd like to ask Mr. Homans to talk about why he chose to adopt a mixed-breed shelter dog instead of shopping. Can he share with readers the fact that most stores source from puppy mills and share why adoption is the life-saving way to go? I'd love people to hear about how Stella's a great dog to dispel the idea that shelter pets are second best.
Well, you know, I think that shelter pets, I think I realize and know and have written that shelter pets are as good or better than purebred dogs, because purebred dogs may, some of them anyway, suffer from might be inbred, and there has been increasing pressure on the AKC and the Kennel Club in England to change their policies to make inbred breeding less prevalent. It's increasingly being seen as an animal welfare issue, but I never really seriously. I've had purebred dogs, but with this dog, I never seriously considered shopping for, partly because I realized that maybe inbreeding was a problem, and I wasn't in love with the fashion of having a purebred dog, and I never seriously considered getting anything from a rescue dog. And I think in New York City, and in a lot of cities, you know, certainly in my dog runs, there is many mixed breeds as there are purebreds, and I think that in some ways these days mixed breeds are just as fashionable or more fashionable than purebred dogs. Partly because purebreeding the kennel organizations have mismanaged their rules to produce dogs that in some cases really have serious health issues.
Mm-hmm. Let's. Go ahead, John.
Go ahead. So yeah, I mean, I think number one, I mean, I think that's a reason why also I think that the mythology of that, you know, the dog, most of the purebred dogs, the dogs that we see is, I mean, Irish setters and English setters, and the dogs that we know as the purebred dogs of today were created at one specific period which was in the 1870s, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s in England, and it's not these weren't always the breeds of dogs. They were created by breeders at this specific moment, and then sort of embalmed in these organizations. And I think that at this point, although it's fantastic to look at the Westminster Dog Show and see this variety and this art. But I think that people are a little are pretty far away from the from that mythology now, and it doesn't have as much power. Whereas, you know, a mixed breed dog, a rescue dog, is something that people feel good. It makes people feel good about themselves, that they're doing something to help the world and help these animals. And you are doing that. It's a fantastic thing. But that movement has been tremendously successful in the last 30 years. I mean, in the 70s, we're killing maybe 20 million dogs and cats in America, which is a huge number. And now the number is more like 4 million or something. It's been really, and that is just in statistical terms. The work isn't done, but the euthanasia numbers have been. I mean, the rescue movement is a great success. There's more work to do.
Right.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with John Homans, 1-800-743-9576, or radio or email. That's radio@wlrn.org. First up, we have Roger. He's in Pembroke Pines. Thanks for your patience, Raj.
First of all, good afternoon to all.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
We have a wonderful seven-year-old mini schnauzer. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she's had a lot of health issues from being diabetic and getting insulin twice a day to having a very expensive eye implant. Lens implant, because she actually went blind and they had to put lenses in her eyes so she could see again, which she does. So we're very thankful for that. But my question is, my wife does everything for this little dog, from feeding her, bathing her, giving her her insulin shots. She's there 100%. But the dog is absolutely crazy about me. She will, if we call the dog and I'm in the room and my wife calls her, she will totally ignore my wife, come to me. It's gotten to a point where when we take her for a walk in the afternoons, if she doesn't see me there, she'll just put her, we say she's putting it in four-wheel drive, because she'll put her feet down and she will not budge. Once she sees me, then she goes for the walk.
Maybe the fear of shots has something to do with that.
No, I don't think so. She asked me, and because she accepts the shot, she gives her the shot, and then a treat comes after that. So she accepts that. She's not scared of it. But I tell her maybe she sees me as an alpha male and more respect than anything.
I think that it's certainly possible that in a wolf pack, the alpha, the male is the daddy, the male is dominant, which doesn't mean that the female, the alpha female, the mother doesn't have huge, considerable power in even over the alpha. So I would say that's possible. And if you're bigger than your wife, that would also create a certain amount of respect.
Have anything to do with it?
And I think I'm not an expert in this, but I would imagine, and it's possible, you probably know as much as I do about this, but I would imagine that all those kind of quasi-sexual indicators probably go into a package that is kind of pretty compelling, without necessarily saying it's alpha. But those are signifiers that certainly have a lot of power in wolf packs, and one would think that they had some power among dogs in dogs too. Not always, but my dog is afraid of and respects big dogs, and seems to have a special feeling for big male dogs, and seems to be a little bit afraid of big female dogs. I mean, there's all those. There's lots of things alike. There's a whole kind of underground kind of language of kind that I think is at work that I haven't necessarily parsed out, but I think it's definitely at work there.
When you say that Stella's afraid of big female dogs, she's not small herself. I mean, she's a lab, right?
No, she's not. She's a little bit smaller than a lab. She probably has some chow, or she has a purple tongue. She's a little bit smaller than a big lab, but she is, she's definitely, she has, and I this may be a result of her shelter dog experiences, but she has, in some circumstances, she can be fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And she can be fearful of, and she's very, very conscious of sight and animals. And she's very conscious, she won't approach, if there are two other dogs, she won't approach. If there's one, she's happy. But if there's two, she really wants to give it, she sees that as a danger and wants to give that a wide berth.
You tell us that there are almost 20 million dogs more in 2010 than there were in 1996. So how do we account for the increase?
Well, I think, other scientists or sociologists and thinkers about pets have noted this, that you know, dogs, I mean, you'd think that we become more urban and you know, there would be less dogs in a city like New York, but dogs have been, dogs have been exploding in both you know, the United States and all over the developed world. And the reason might be that they've been, are you familiar with a book, Bowling Alone, about how much more solitary and less familial our lives are?
Right.
Have been becoming gradually over the last three or four decades that we're less connected with our families. And dogs, these scientists think that dogs are filling these gaps in our increasingly lonely, worlds without these enormous extended families that people in other places have to, and so the people need this kind of contact. And dogs, they fill those gaps pretty well. They're, your brain chemistry when you're interacting with a dog is pretty similar to when you're interacting with a person. So dogs really make sense in that context because they can be a family member. They can be a person. They can be a surrogate friend and surrogate. I think that there's a lot of truth in that.
Right. We're speaking with John Homans. He's the executive editor of New York Magazine. His book is What's a Dog For? On today's Topical Currents, one more short break, and we'll be right back. Please stay with us.
And 48 minutes past 1 o'clock, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and John Homans. He's the author of What's a Dog For? John, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
I think you'd have to go to the Penguin website. I never created a website for this.
Well, good for you.
us.penguingroup.com, and you could find that, but I never created a website. Not that I'm a Luddite, but I never did it.
Can you tell us about that interesting study that shows that dogs are better stress relievers than our spouses?
Well, yeah, has been a thread of this has been a it does it's not that surprising.
Right.
This has been a thread of research for a while. But what's her name? The beginning of it was that they found someone did a study and found that people with dogs, have survived after heart surgery more than people who don't have dogs or pets, actually, it was. But then more recently, a researcher did a study where she had people do stressful tasks like counting backwards I think it was counting backwards by threes, which is surprisingly stressful and difficult, and found that people it was easier for people to do it when a pet was in the room than when a spouse was in the room, because the implication is that the snap analysis, which I think is certainly true, is that that a pet is not, your dog is not going to judge you if you can't count backwards by threes,
right.
Whereas your spouse may secretly think that you're kind of a dope if you can't do it, and that puts added pressure on. And I think that's when after a hard day at work, that non-judgmental love is very, very, is very welcoming and very easy to accept and uncomplicated in ways that It's the science proved the old saws about, if you need a friend in Washington, get a dog, and man's best friend and all this.
Right.
What did Byron say? It was all man's virtues with none of his faults. I mean, it was, it's just an easy, and Freud, there's a long thread of people thinking about this, and very smart people thinking very sentimental thoughts about the dog. And so it's not that surprising that scientists found a way to confirm the truth of these things.
Right.
Let's take another quick call. We've got Fiorella in Coral Gables. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, this is a very fascinating topic. Thank you. My question actually has to do with what you guys just were talking about, which I've been thinking about why it is that the dogs in particular are so capable of eliciting sympathy and like human emotion from humans to the point where humans are not able to elicit that same level of emotion or empathy quite often. And, you know, with what the author has been pointing out, to the fact that, you know, these campaigns for dog rights have been so successful, it's interesting to sort of compare them to, for instance, like poverty campaigns to do with children, and how it is that it seems to me, at least, that it would be the dog that would elicit more sympathy. And, you know, so it, maybe just I would like to hear what the author has to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's true, and it's vexing. You know, I think one thing I wrote about briefly is that, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, it wasn't right after, but you know, there was two or three weeks after Hurricane Katrina, you had really an army. I mean, it's a great success of the rescue world, but you had an army of animal rescue volunteers coming down to, you know, to help the lost animals of New Orleans, and they did a fantastic job. There's been other conflicts that have arisen afterward, but they did a fantastic job, and they made the marks on the sides of the houses, and they came back. But a lot of people in those neighborhoods in the Ninth and in those neighborhoods were pissed off and said, why there is all this outpouring of sympathy and help for these animals, yet when we needed help, they really weren't. It wasn't there. So I think that there is an issue, and I didn't write extensively about this, but I think it is. You know, I think it's related to what we were just talking about, which is that, you know, with people, there are all these kind of tribal distinctions. I mean, if they're you know, you might not, and you're more concerned about your family, and you might be more concerned. I mean, if you're not a good person, you might be more concerned about your own ethnic group or your own religious group or your own. I mean, and certainly that's true in the world. Whereas with dogs are more you know, they need your help, and they're not going to judge you, and they're not in conflict with you, and it's a kind of the feeling of helping a dog is very pure, and I think that that's part of its appeal, which is not to say that we shouldn't help dogs, but I think it's worth always, when you're thinking about animals, it's worth thinking about what empathy is and why we do it, and why we're doing this and not things, and what more we could do. And I think that is something that having a dog makes me think about.
Do you think, I'm sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was just wondering if there's science about whether dogs are always in the moment, or if they harbor memories of the past and hopes for the future, or if they're just always here.
I don't think they plan their retirement or anything.
No, I don't think so.
You know, I think the folk notion is that they always, I didn't research this, that part of things deeply. The folk notion is that they are in the moment, and I think that they are in the moment, and that's a beautiful thing about a dog. I quoted a very sad John Updike poem about the death of his dog, and the mm-hmm. dog comes along and watches his owner dig its grave, and that's something that a person couldn't do, and it's just unbearably poignant and sad. But I think that dogs certainly—I mean, a dog's dream. Dogs certainly have a memory enough to have a sense of, and therefore would have to have a sense of time passing. I don't think, and I think that they have probably more. I think that they are awash, and Stella certainly is awash in her emotions. But it doesn't mean that there's not there couldn't be something like reflection or memory or I think Stella remembers places and wants that she loves and wants to get back there, certainly. And Stella, when she comes to someone that she used to know or she met, she's ecstatic, and she's like, it's just, she's come back to some paradise that was sort of denied her when she sees someone she's saw a couple years ago on the street.
Well,
so
it's certainly been a pleasure. We're about out of time, John Homans.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
John Homans, New York Magazine executive editor, and he's also the author of What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend. And John, for Bonnie and I, would you maybe give Stella a treat?
A little hug.
She'll get it anyway. I'll say it's from you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And thanks for listening this hour. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads of past programs at the WLRN.org webpage. Also, more information at the Topical Currents Facebook site, including links to books such as today's. Tomorrow's program discusses Florida alimony and divorce laws. There'll be a push for reform in the 2013 Florida legislative session, particularly to overhaul permanent alimony stipends and remarriages. And to the calendar, on this day in 1845, 168 years ago, Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven is published, making him a celebrity. It's written in trochaic octameter. Quote the Raven nevermore. And on this day in 1880, 133 years ago, the birth of W.C. Fields in Philadelphia, of course. He died on the day he most despised, Christmas. One more. On this day in 1954, 59 years ago, the birth of Oprah Winfrey in rural Mississippi. She wore potato sacks and was the world's first black billionaire. One of her many abodes is on Miami's Fisher Island. Theme music created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from W.C. Fields, who at age 21 was a world-class juggler. Quote, "Ah, yes, reminds me of my safari in Africa. Somebody forgot the corkscrew. For several days, we had to live on nothing but food and water." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.